Would you introduce yourself, please?
Sure, I'm Willie Nile. I live in New York City, and I write songs, make records, and give shows, performances with my band as often as I can.
You are a veteran rock and roll singer, songwriter. Late 70s, Lower East Side, first record 1980, and then you were, quote, took a sabbatical. I love the word sabbatical.
I walked away from the record business.
Yes, sabbatical. We're going to get into that. Back in 91, Streets of New York, 96, an album a year, 14 in all.
I like where I am. I like the world around me. I don't need a question to stir me. You know, I'm pretty driven and passionate as it is. I took classical piano lessons as a kid. My grandfather was a vaudeville orchestra leader, and my brothers brought rock and roll records home. There was always a lot of music on. And they took classical piano, and I took lessons from the age of 8. You know, regular classical piano, scales, learning, reading notes and stuff. And I liked a lot of it, you know, and didn't like some of it. And I went to school 1 year. When I got out of high school, I basically just partied in high school, you know, and listened to music, chased girls, you know, the usual. And when it came time to go to college, I couldn't get in. And so I went to my guidance counselor. I mean, I never had to study. I was quick enough where I could just do well and pass. And I said, you know, I'm looking for college, you know, and he said, there's a college in near Canton, Ohio, that just built a new dorm and needs out-of-state students. So basically all the losers, all the troublemakers ended up in this dormitory in 3 miles north of Canton, Ohio. The Hoover factory was 3 miles down the road. Anyway, my roommate played the guitar. Denny Wentz from Pittsburgh, PA. Next time I play Pittsburgh, I got to try to find him to see if he's still around. He had a guitar, you know, and here's something interesting that I never get asked or whatever. Just why would I? He played the guitar, you know, was a righty. And I do things with both hands. I play pool, lefty, bow and arrow, whatever. You know, I do a lot of things left-handed, and I throw baseball right-handed, shoot basketball right-handed. I write right-handed, but that could be just because in first grade, the teacher might have said, put the pen in your right hand. And I probably did. So I can do things with both hands, but playing the guitar, there's no question whatsoever, lefty. And he had a regular guitar, and what am I going to do with that? So I learned to play righty. Haven't been the same since. So yeah, I learned to play, you know, the opposite way. And that's where I learned to play the guitar. And when I went back to Buffalo, where I grew up, for, I don't know, the Christmas break or whatever, I sat down at the piano. On the guitar, I was playing chords, you know, G, E minor, C, D, whatever chords, you know, B minor. And I sat at the piano, I just looked at the keys, and I hit a chord. And I had another chord, and I retaught myself the piano through the eyes of a guitar player. I mean, I'm not much of a guitar player, but I play a chordal. There's a guy on PBS called the Piano Guy, Scott Houston. Amazing. He does the same thing. I remember I was in Sweden, 4 a.m. You know, I just got there. I was wide awake watching TV, and I see this guy talk about teaching adults to play a keyboard, piano, and it's the same thing. You play two chords. You could play No Woman, No Cry, 3 chords, A minor, G, and F. Boom, No Woman, No Cry. Boom, No Woman, No. And I taught myself. And I still, to this day, when I play the piano, I'm just looking at chords. I can riff around them now. So that's, you know, yeah, I learned to play guitar the opposite way.
Pneumonia entered your life, and then so did, and I'm going to say it correctly, because somebody the other day turned to me and said, oh, did you go to CBGB's? Those bands coming from Buffalo, and you enter that place, where did it hit you? Where was that moment where you said, uh-oh, this is going to be what I'm going to be doing?
Well, when I first came here, I used to hitchhike from Buffalo, you know, in summertime. My guitar, I'd sleep in the park. I did that a few times. And I love the village. I found it fascinating. I love history. I love the history of the village. I love the beat poets, you know, Gregory Corso, Ginsberg. And I love that whole stream of consciousness thing. And the magic and mystery of the village, you know, from the early acoustic folky days to the Love and Spoonful, Frank Zappa, Jimi Hendrix, you know, Bob Dylan, all that stuff. When I came here, I was walking the streets. I just was amazed. I still am walking the streets. I still look around with those new eyes, so to speak, and just look around because it's always changing. And yeah, it was transformational for me. Still is.
You've been through a lot of record labels, and I've heard you tell the tale of being, you know, at Arista Records in that big room with way too many people judging you. And but that's an interesting thing. Because you didn't go you signed with a major and they kind of looked at you.
I got that done with a 6-string guitar. I mean, I came here and I was writing rock and roll songs. You know, I grew up with British Invasion, all the great stuff that was on the radio in the 60s, from Motown to R&B to wacky country stuff to all that stuff. I grew up on that and I wrote songs of all kinds. But when I came, I had no money, as poor as a church mouse, and I didn't want to join a group. I had no interest whatsoever. I just wanted to play the songs I was writing. And so I would just find open mics, you know, and play there. And I would tell them, these are rock and roll songs, you know. I would jump around the stage, introduce imaginary musicians behind me, literally, you know. And, you know, it took some time, but eventually, you know, I was playing at Kenny's Castaways, which was the perfect venue for me because I used to go out on CBs. I played CBGBs before it became the Mecca. It was a jazz pianist who played. It was a musical act for the evening. You know, he was a really nice guy. He was a professor at City College, and he set me up and, you know, sound checked me when I played there. And Kenny's Castaways one night, Don Hill, a dear friend, he was managing Kenny's Castaways, and he got a phone call from Robert Palmer, New York Times writer, and Robert was going to come by to see the headliner, review the headliner, you know, and his daily rounds. And Don Hill, God bless him, he said, you might want to come and see the opening, the guy who's opening. You might be, you know, you should come early. And he did. He was curious enough that he came early. I remember being on stage that night, you know, I was opening the show. You'd play six nights a week, two sets. 2 40-minute sets, you know, and I'm on stage playing, opening set, small crowd, 20 people, something like that, 30 people. And this guy, two, three rows back, is like, he looked like a little round glasses, intellectual-looking guy, you know, and I could tell he was really digging it. I didn't know it was. I didn't know that it all went down until afterwards. You know, ignorance is bliss, and sometimes. So I'm introducing, you know, different imaginary musicians behind me, jumping off the stage to accent the end of the song, basically just having a good time with the songs and singing a wide variety of material. Well, turns out I get off the stage and they tell me it's Robert Palmer of the New York Times and he wants to meet you. So I met him and he was really nice. And he wrote this incredible article, you know, and a review saying, you know, the Times rarely produces an artist of certain, whatever. You know, he said a lot of nice things about me and I got signed to Arista. The next night, Clive Davis is in the audience. Columbia Records is in the audience. I step off the stage. It was packed. It was fascinating to see from the inside of that hurricane. And I step off the stage. Paul Rothschild, I produced the Doors. I didn't even get off the stage. He gives me his card. I'm Paul Rothschild. I produced the Doors. I'd like to work with you, you know, which was, I thought, wow, crazy, you know. And the interesting thing for me was right behind Clive Davis was Lux Interior and Ivy Rorschach of the Cramps, right behind Clive. You know, it was so, I knew them a little bit and I love the Cramps. So I got signed to a major label playing a 6-string guitar, opening for somebody on Bleecker Street, a buddy of mine. And I didn't want to join a group. I couldn't pay guys. I had no money. And I got signed to a major.
So we.
On Arista, Columbia.
Right.
And I've been putting my own records out since 99.
I don't think that what you went through is a bad thing because it got you to the other side. Right? And it got you.
I don't consider it a bad thing at all. I mean, I walked away from the business after two albums when it became, I mean, you know, I was overhyped big time. You know, the record company tried for me and I'm grateful for that. I really am. You know, I saw Clive a few years ago. It was a Patti Smith event. You know, it was good to see him. You know, people tried for me. It's nothing's easy. you know, and I got to tour with the Who across the U.S. Who would ever have even imagined that? How can you, you're a kid in Buffalo, New York with a guitar. Arista tried for me, and but when I became, I had trouble with a lawyer, former manager, and, you know, I was going to arbitration during the day, doing interviews all day, gigging at night. And I thought, the hell with this, you know, and I just didn't want it to kill my buzz for music. I love music. And I said to my wife at the time, I said, let's get out of here. You know, I don't want to deal with these people. And it wasn't the label. They weren't the ones that, that drove me away. It was just, you know, there's wolves around, people smell money, you know, and it was always music for me. I don't give a damn about fame, you know, stinking rich. I'd love to be stinking rich. Well, I lived off of what money I had, borrowed money, worked at the post office, and then signed to Columbia Records, you know, and I never, you know, the thing, you asked me what one of my first impressions coming to New York was, how a lot of musicians had chips on their shoulder, the size of Mount Rushmore, you know, I just thought, I don't want to be that guy, you know, people just like, oh, I deserve this. I never felt like that. And I never, I had that jealousy, but if somebody got successful, go for it, you know, more power to you.
Yeah.
I didn't have that problem, which it is. And that's one thing that really struck me, that, that people had chips on their shoulder. I've been on two major labels, consider myself lucky to have done that. I've got to, I recorded with Richard Thompson, you know, I've had some, so many amazing things happen to me, and I'm grateful for it. You know, it's taught me a lot. It's made me a better songwriter. That time away from 10 years away from the record business made me a better songwriter, because I was able to woodshed away from the cameras. It was great. It turned out to be it was really difficult as a parent, but really good for me as an artist. And now I just put out 9 records in 12 years.
This record that we're talking about, it does something, and you do something that that for me is the oldest trick in the book and the most important trick in the book. But you've made a record that does all the things that every record that people like you and I have loved, whether it's Dylan, you know, I would, in that it's the oldest trick. It's really melodic. It's beautifully crafted. The songs are well written, but man, if you listen to the lyrics, if you take the time to actually say, wow, as I'm dancing, as he's entrancing me, as I'm realizing, oh, wait a minute, from absolute tragedy and insanity and craziness does come great art.
I look for, you know, I look for, I'm more positive than negative. I look for the good. And I'm, this record, I'm so happy with it. I got to, you know, it's the culmination of all these years of learning, experimenting, trying, failing, you know, succeeding, all of the above. And it's seamless. The day the earth stood still, I'm so...
But you're teaching people, Willie, the ABCs of logic, the CEOs of grief, the SROs. You're also...
You know, when I wrote that, when I sit here and wrote that, when the, I was writing that song, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and it just flew out of me. I was just trusting my instincts. When the ABCs of logic meet the CEOs of greed and the SROs of loneliness cry out and start to bleed, there comes a time for judgment, a time to pay the bill. And that is just the way it was the day the earth stood still. That came out and I went, what?
The thing that comes out of New York a lot from friends is it'll never be the same. It'll never come back.
Well, there's a thing is there's a song on the album called Expect Change.
Yes.
And during the course of this past year, I mean, I wrote most of the songs last year and within the last year, a number of them in the fall. And I thought, well, things change, whether for better or for worse. But the one thing you can count on is that things are going to change, you know, and sometimes better. So try to roll with it. We try to do the best we can with it. Otherwise, you're just, you know, you're sitting duck for change. And I try to roll with it as best I can. And think about New York. There's a great Hemingway book called A Movable Feast. And I read it when I got out of college, you know, and it's about his life in Paris in the 20s. You know, boxing with Picasso in the morning, going to Belgium for lunch with a buddy, coming, being at Gertrude Stein's salon in the evening. And I've seen New York change. I came here in 72, and I've seen it evolve, you know, deep, get better, worse, all of the above. It just keeps changing. It's going to keep changing. There's still magic here. That's the thing. I'm a poet. I walk the streets. It still speaks to me. Even during the worst of lockdown, when there was nobody out, I still could hear it talking to me. I love it here. Will it be the same? Nothing's the same.
And you know, having a neighbor in Steve Earle is not exactly a problem, is it?
Steve is, we become friends, you know, I run into him all the time. He lives right around the corner, literally 3-4 buildings away. And yeah, he's been great. He sang on the Blood on Your Hands. You know, I texted him, hey, I got the song on the album. I don't know if you're around. And he sang on it, and he did a great job singing it. It sounds so street, so edgy, which the song is. It's not about getting awards and getting on charts. It's about making the music and whatever it reveals to the writer or to the listener. Therein lies the magic. You love music. You do what you do because you can't not do it. You love it because it means something to you. It means something, like for me, the songs help explain the planet to me, you know?
But you and Stuart, you have a pretty amazing working relationship, because...
Thanks for mentioning Stuart Lerman. Yeah, Stuart does all Marty Scorsese's productions since The Aviator. You know, Robbie Robertson might write a song and get the credit as executive producer, but Stuart does all the production for most of the music. And it's not a knock on Robbie. Robbie's great. I love Robbie. Oh, my God. My band is one of my favorite bands ever. But Stuart Lerman has worked with, you know, from Patti Smith to Elvis Costello to you name it. And his bedside manner in a studio, his sense of groove, you know, his sense of, you know, feel is just, you can't fake that. You can't make that up. And I've been working with him since 87, 88, when I got signed to Columbia. I love the guy. I'll make records till one of us drops, you know? I'm lucky. It's a team. The record sounds as good as it does, not just because of me, because I'm not that knowledgeable about too many things, but I got the team around me. Stuart Lerman, you know, James Frazee. James Frazee engineered it. My band, Jimmy K. Bones on guitar, who's a real producer in his own right, a serious one. Johnny Bizzano on the bass, John Weber on drums. Great players, you know, and it's a team effort, and it sounds, I put it on and I go, man.
So I know that everybody except you and your band, you know, on a fateful day managed to get sick, but everybody made it. You didn't. That's what I'm saying. So the whole band did. You did it, but everybody made it through.
They made it through. My lead guitar player cracked. He coughed so hard for 1 week, he cracked 4 ribs. And last March, right, we did a gig February 29th, 2020, and they all got it. And the opening act, James Maddock, who's amazing, he got it. His girlfriend got it. I didn't get it. I don't know why.
That's lucky. But you're tiptoeing back, right? Very carefully.
Oh, you know, I'll tell you what, carefully enough, I've been on, from September to April, I was on 20 flights, 8 of them overseas.
Wow.
You know, my girlfriend, I just got married, but my girlfriend lives in Italy in the north. So I was going back and forth. I flew 20 flights between September and April. And so I've been very cavalier, but I had a face shield on. I was covered up. Wow. I was 17 hours with a mask, a face shield and gloves going from JFK to Rome and then Rome to Milan. I did it. You know, you'll do things for love.
So what I've done is I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs on the outside and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.